Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with growing international outrage at the barbaric behavior of Saudi Arabia's Crown Prince MBS, who more evidence increasingly implicates as the author of the butchery of a dissident and Washington Post columnist. Yet MBS has yet to even come up with any explanation for the disappearance of Jamal Khashoggi, who was last seen entering the Saudi consulate in Istanbul. Shireen Aladimi, an assistant professor of education at Michigan State University, who is originally from Yemen, joins us to discuss her article at NBC News, Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi's disappearance has accomplished what 50,000 Yemeni deaths could not. We will look into the possibility that as Trump tries to offer cover to MBS, whose arrogance and impunity knows no bounds, the evidence the Turks are holding back on will be released and will be so damning that the Congress will be forced to act. Although it is clear from complaints by Bob Corker, the Republican chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, that the White House is preventing U.S. intelligence agencies from sharing what they know with lawmakers, it seems likely that Congress will eventually sanction Saudi Arabia. With bills already in the House and Senate to cut off U.S. military and logistical support for MBS's cruel and pointless war in Yemen, there may be a respite for the Yemeni people facing what the UN calls the worst humanitarian crisis on the planet, initiated by the impetuous brutality of Saudi Arabia's incompetent boy king. Then we will speak with the Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter and columnist for the Los Angeles Times, Michael Hilsig, about his latest article at the LA Times, how profiteering by the same dialysis firms trying to kill Proposition 8 almost destroyed Obamacare. We will examine how the country's two biggest monopolies in the dialysis clinic business, DaVita and Fresenius, are spending a record-breaking $100 million plus on deceptive advertising to defeat Proposition 8 after having almost destroyed Obamacare by encouraging Medicare patients to sign up to the Affordable Care Act to have a pre-existing condition covered. These dialysis monopolies then gouged the insurance companies and made such exorbitant profits they forced big insurance companies to opt out of Obamacare. Then finally, Stephen Walt, Professor of International Affairs at Harvard University, joins us to discuss his article at Foreign Policy, This is America's Middle East Strategy on Steroids, and his latest book just out, The Hell of Good Intentions, America's Foreign Policy Elite and the Decline of U.S. Primacy. And while Trump is such a wrecking crew, he makes the foreign policy elite look good, we will explore how we can have greater security if we stop trying to bomb enemies real and imagined and took better care of our own people and stood as a more authentic example of democratic values. And joining us now is Shireen Aladimi, who is an assistant professor of education at Michigan State University. Originally from Yemen, she has been working to bring attention to the U.S.'s role in the ongoing war on Yemen and has an article at NBC News, Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi's disappearance has accomplished what 50,000 Yemeni deaths could not. Welcome to Background Briefing, Shireen Aladimi.
Thank you.
And
thank you for having me.
Just explain the headline again here. What do you feel that Jamal Khashoggi's disappearance has done in terms of what 50,000 Yemeni deaths has failed to do?
Well, for once, it garnered sustained media attention, which is really surprising for a foreign policy issue to sustain the interests of the media. But I think it's not surprising given who he was and the connections that he had with various media sources. But I think it also elicited a lot of outrage against the Saudi crown prince, Mohammed bin Salman. And this is kind of unprecedented since he took power in 2015. He's been heralded by various sources as a reformer, as, quote, emancipating women, as somebody who's really trying to bring reform to the region. And we saw when he was in the U.S. earlier this year, he was welcomed by the business community, by political elite, by media sources. And so it's unusual for there to be such a huge backlash against Mohammed bin Salman, given what he's been involved in Yemen over the last 3.5 years. But I think just, you know, the details of Khashoggi's disappearance and murder have just been so gruesome that it finally got the people's attention onto Saudi Arabia.
Well, it has got the people's attention, but one of the things that I find lacking is that the obvious connection is not made in the sense that what the Crown Prince and his henchmen did is exactly what the Islamic State does, that kind of butchery. And, of course, it was inadvertently caught on tape by Turkish intelligence, as opposed to the Islamic State, who videotape and want the whole world to see their barbarity. But, I mean, it seems to me explodes the whole idea that somehow Saudi Arabia is an ally, as opposed to behaving like the U.S.'s enemy, the Islamic State.
Absolutely. I mean, it's no secret that they've been funding various terror organizations over the last, you know, decades. And that seems to be overlooked for some reason. Well, the reason, I think, is because they're also, you know, swimming in money. And so there's a lot of money to be made from the relationship with Saudi Arabia. But, you know, a lot of this thing is usually, a lot of their actions, their barbarity, like you mentioned, is usually covert when it comes to, I mean, the details of Khashoggi's murder highlight kind of the fact that these people have done this before. You know, they're talking about listening to music while they go through this procedural act of dismembering somebody. And so this isn't something that seems to be new to them. And in Yemen, we've seen that they've teamed up with Al-Qaeda at various times and, you know, in their fight against the Houthis. So, and we know what Al-Qaeda does and what they're capable of doing. And so for many of us who've been following Yemen and Saudi Arabia's actions in the region in general, it's not too surprising, but it's just kind of catapulted them into Western, you know, the attention of Western media, I think, because, like you said, it was caught on tape, and there's really no escaping what they've done.
Well, it's really depressing when you think about, I mean, it's, for you being a Yemeni, to think about how your country's being destroyed. It's a humanitarian catastrophe. The UN says it's the worst humanitarian catastrophe on the planet. People are starving. People are being indiscriminately killed, school buses full of children, etc. It's absolutely unconscionable that the U.S. has a role in that. But I think it's in many ways, you have to add to this the context of who our president is. President Trump, his three favorite people on the planet in terms of world leaders seem to be Mohammed bin Salman, Vladimir Putin, and Kim Jong-un, all three of whom have committed these absolutely horrendous atrocities, murdering dissidents on foreign soil. In Kim Jong-un's case, his own half-brother, with an advanced form of nerve gas. Putin used another advanced form of nerve gas to kill some dissident GRU officer in the UK. And MBS, of course, has done this incredible act of butchery, all of which is designed to terrorize their domestic populations. That's why they do it. So that's, I think, the missing piece of this. When all the press and the White House keep talking about how the Saudis are working on some kind of cover story, which Trump has encouraged, he's basically almost been writing it for them. My feeling, Shireen, is that MBS is not going to back down. It's more important to him to send a message to his own people that I can terrorize you, I can get you anywhere in the world if you cross me. And that's Putin's message, and that's Kim Jong-un's message. So do you expect anything from the Saudi royal palace in terms of some kind of explanation for what's happened at their consulate in Istanbul?
No, absolutely not. They're going to deflect and they're going to deny. And again, this is not unfamiliar to those of us who've been following their responses to the atrocities that they've been committing in Yemen. They either say, well, we didn't do it, which is, you know, kind of just an outright lie because they're the only ones capable of causing that kind of destruction. They're the only ones with the kinds of weapons that would cause that kind of destruction. Or they say, yep, we meant to do it, you know, so what? You know, or they get tasked with investigating their own crimes, and then they absolve themselves, of course. And so Mohammed bin Salman has been getting away with this for 3.5 years since he began the war in Yemen, since he became crown prince or deputy crown prince at the time. And, you know, the world has not been holding him accountable. In fact, he's been supported by much of the international community, including Trump, including the Obama administration. They've joined in, they've sold him weapons, they've helped him commit these atrocities in Yemen, all for the sake of prioritizing the incredible amount of money that they're making off of him. Trump, in a couple of press conferences so far, has made that connection very clear. He said, yeah, you know, maybe something happened to the journalist, but we're not going to stop these contracts that we've made with the kingdom. And he likes to quote a $110 billion figure, which isn't accurate, but it is, you know, his motivation. So, you know, is it different for Mohammed bin Salman to butcher somebody in the way that he did, is that different than dropping a bomb on children or blockading an entire country and causing people inside to suffer and to die in masses? The barbarity is the same, but I think what happened with Khashoggi is that there's a name, there's a face to what had happened, and this is a person who's well-liked and connected to the international community. And finally, we see what this Crown Prince is capable of doing and the degree to which he's been provided impunity and support from the international community that has allowed him to go this far.
And I'm speaking with Shireen Aladimi, who's an assistant professor of education at Michigan State University. Originally from Yemen, she has been working to bring attention to the U.S.'s role in the ongoing war in Yemen and has an article at NBC News. Saudi journalist Kamal Khashoggi's disappearance has accomplished what 50,000 Yemeni deaths could not. But I think also, when you think about this sense of impunity, this sense of unlimited power that this crown prince has, and he's wielding it to terrorize his own people, but particularly the elite. We know that he's put a whole bunch of them, held them prisoner in the Ritz-Carlton Hotel, which is, by the way, where they're going to be holding their Davos in the Desert gathering. And, of course, we know now that the Secretary of Treasury is not going, but Goldman Sachs is going, and so is PepsiCo. So people, I think, ought to be boycotting both of those companies. But the way that I understand the impunity of the Saudi royals, the idea that they have absolute power and how they say power goes to your head. Well, my sense is that MBS, the deal is if we give you money, like Khashoggi was on the Saudi payroll for some time from both Mohammed bin Nayef, the intelligence head and former ambassador, and also Prince Alawid bin Talal. He was on his payroll. They're apparently very close. He was the guy that MBS held prisoner and shook him down and confiscated a lot of his fortune. But the way it operates, from my understanding, is from Khashoggi's point of view, you take money from the royal family, they own you. And the reason that MBS was furious with him was that he's reneged on the deal. We own you. How dare you criticize us? And I think that same mentality applies to Trump and Kushner. I'm sure they've all gotten a lot of money from the Saudis. So the Saudis' attitude is we own Trump and we own Kushner. What do you think of that thesis?
I think this is how they've been operating in general since their foundation. The Saudi royal family has been throwing money at various causes and various interests. And, you know, their way of dealing with the world is just to throw money and get what they want. And the world community, the international community, has responded positively to that. And they've been willing to take money from people and not question the strings attached that come along with it. But I think when you talk about, you know, Saudi critics or dissidents, whether they're on the payroll or not, these are people who are afraid to go back home if they ever raise any concerns or if they're ever critical about the Saudi government or anything really within Saudi. You know, we've seen examples of the Saudi government sending emails to students telling them not to talk about the war in Yemen, not to spread fake news online, whatever they define as fake news, you know, and threatening them with 5 years of jail time if they spread any kind of propaganda against the kingdom. Even though these people are not on the, you know, they're students, you can argue that they're receiving scholarships from the Saudi government, but they've been terrorizing their own citizens into silence. And in Jamal Khashoggi's case, this is somebody, like you said, who was very well connected to the royal family, and even he had to feel the need to be in self-exile, and he talked about being afraid of his life. You know, they just expect people to completely support the government no matter what, or at the very least stay silent and not express any dissident views.
Well, a couple of the 9/11 hijackers who was here in Los Angeles and then went down to San Diego, they accidentally, this is the story the Saudis put out, that their consul general and this other fellow who was a Saudi intelligence officer over here, whose specific job was to monitor Saudi students and make sure they weren't getting too liberal and in any way would criticize the royal family. This guy organized the two hijackers, gave them lodgings down in San Diego, and of course they also got money from the Saudi ambassador's wife. To my mind, the mentality of somebody like MBS who would think that he could do this and he doesn't care about the consequences, and he's got Trump and Pompeo and the White House scrambling to help him out with the cover story. I don't think he gives a damn about what they think. Again, there's something going on here that I think the American people are missing in terms of the attitudes that the Saudi royals have towards the United States. The best explanation would be a kind of a love-hate relationship, but that barely scratches the surface. How would you describe it?
I mean, it is a really a very bizarre relationship. The U.S. likes to emphasize their concern for human rights and whatnot, and then, you know, they're close allies with a country that has made no effort to hide their human rights abuses. As we speak, they allowed women to drive, which, by the way, is nothing to be celebrated. They were the only country in the world that didn't allow women to drive. But, simultaneously, they've been imprisoning women, female activists who've fought very long and hard for this basic right and for other rights within the kingdom. But we continue to be allies with them. So it's a very strange, contradictory relationship. There were some very valid questions that should have been raised after 9/11, some of the things that you just mentioned, and, 15 out of the 19 hijackers were Saudi. And that was just never followed through, I feel like. I feel like the American public and the American media and the American, government has just been giving them a pass. And, at what point do we say, well, no, we can't give these people passes anymore. They are very destructive to their own citizens, to citizens around the world. They're operating like a big bully in the Middle East and elsewhere. They've been threatening the United States with repercussions. They threatened senators, essentially, the day that senators signed that act saying that, we need to find out what's going on with the Khashoggi's case or impose sanctions. That same day, they sent threats against anybody who's working against the kingdom. And so these aren't the kind of people that anybody needs to be associated with. They should be isolated. They should not be supported. They should not be thought of as allies.
Well, just in the last couple of minutes, Shireen, turning back to Yemen and the ongoing atrocity there, do you think, given that some of senators that have been supportive of the Trump administration and are on the Foreign Relations Committee, like Lindsey Graham, of course, the chair, Bob Corker, and also Marco Rubio, Corker's basically been complaining that he's not getting intelligence about what happened in the Saudi consulate, which indicates, and he says basically the Trump administration is blocking the senators finding out exactly what the Saudis did. But we know that Lindsey Graham has been quite critical and said that MBS is a wrecking ball and he's got to go. Is it going to affect their U.S. support for this war in terms of supplying bombs, targeting, and intelligence?
Well, that's the big question, and that's what I really hope this is going to translate to. Lindsey Graham, just a couple of years ago, was defending Saudi Arabia's, selling weapons to Saudi Arabia in light of the Yemen conversation. This is when Rand Paul was trying to ban sales of weapons to Saudi Arabia, and Lindsey Graham made a speech and he just basically said, well, if we don't sell them weapons, somebody else will. And he defended that relationship, that financial relationship. And now here he is kind of working against it. Bob Corker had a big hand in tabling SJ Res 54, which again was, Bernie Sanders' attempt to stop all kinds of involvement, U.S. involvement in Yemen. And they ended up tabling it instead. So now we see this momentum building, which is really great. This should have happened many, many years ago, but you know what's happening now, and it's got to translate into action. And in the House, I think the litmus test is going to be HCON Res 138, which is probably going to go to a vote in November or early December. And this is another invocation of the War Powers Resolution by Congressman Ro Khanna, who had tried this before in the House and it didn't succeed. But here he is trying it again and working toward ending the U.S.'s involvement in Yemen. And there's been, kind of talk about Bernie Sanders preparing a similar bill in the Senate. So I think all of these people who are highly critical of Saudi Arabia, that momentum needs to keep going, and this relationship needs to be examined closely and then translated into action, translated into voting for these bills that aim to do the very same things that they're talking about.
And on top of that, of course, there's talk of invoking the Global Magnitsky Human Rights Accountability Act as well.
Right.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us. I appreciate the conversation, Shireen Al-Adeimi.
My pleasure. Thanks so much for having me.
And I've been speaking with Shireen Al-Adeimi, who is an assistant professor of education at Michigan State University. Originally from Yemen, she has been working to bring attention to the U.S.'s role in the ongoing war on Yemen and has an article at NBC News, Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi's disappearance has accomplished what 50,000 Yemeni deaths could not. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back speaking with Stephen Walt, the author of the new book just out, The Hell of Good Intentions, America's Foreign Policy Elite and the Decline of U.S. Primacy.
Here and now, our choices here are growing. As children grow, they grow with what they see. And in these times where paranoia closes in, power and hate are rampaging disease. In our minds, we build the blocks to what we need. In our minds, we're reaching out for peace. In our hearts, we know of such the hills to climb. In our hearts, a sense of master feet.
Walk away now, and you're gonna start a war. We expected something, something better than before. We expected something. Walk away now, and you're gonna start a war.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Stephen Walt, the Robert and Renee Belfer Professor of International Affairs at Harvard University. He's the author of The Origins of Alliances, Revolution and War, Taming American Power, The Global Response to U.S. Primacy, and co-author with John Mearsheimer of The Israel Lobby and U.S. Foreign Policy. A frequent writer for Foreign Policy, where his latest article is This is America's Middle East Strategy on Steroids. His latest book just out is The Hell of Good Intentions, America's Foreign Policy Elite and the Decline of U.S. Primacy. Welcome to Background Briefing, Stephen Walt.
Nice to be with you again, Ian.
Well, thank you, Stephen. And just the other day, Senator Lindsey Graham referred to Mohammed bin Salman, the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia, as a wrecking ball and said he's got to go. But clearly, Donald Trump is a bigger wrecking ball. And I'm wondering whether your sort of thesis, which is, I think, welcome and important, that the American foreign policy elite are at the heart of the problem, if you will, are they getting a reprieve because of Trump? Because Trump is such a bull in a china shop that our discredited, or at least they're going to be, that you're trying to discredit them. are they getting a reprieve because of Trump?
Yeah, I think there's some, there may be some truth in that. I mean, what I think the Trump presidency, when it comes to foreign policy, is teaching us is that just because things are bad doesn't mean they can't get worse. Trump ran for the office of president in 2016 being very critical of American foreign policy and very critical of the foreign policy elite, and they repaid him in kind, right? Both Democrats, but especially Republican foreign policy officials, were very critical of Trump and wrote open letters calling him utterly unfit for office. Since he's become president, I think what's most striking about it, of course, is that although the style of his presidency is radically different than all of his predecessors, on many foreign policy issues, he's in fact continued aspects of the past, but done it in a particularly ham-handed way. In the Middle East, for example, he has stuck with all of the traditional American allies that we've had there, Egypt, Saudi Arabia, Israel, the Gulf states, but he's essentially doubled down on American support for them, given them even more unconditional and lavish support. And one of the consequences is the kind of behavior that we're seeing from all of these countries, most recently with what's gone on with Saudi Arabia and the apparent murder of a dissident journalist. Similarly, previous American administrations, had stayed in Afghanistan, and Trump, just like Obama before him, sends more troops, prolongs that war, despite the fact that he had run for office saying we were going to get out of the nation-building business. So, again, the style of the Trump presidency is so chaotic and disorganized and, I would argue, incompetent, that in some respects it has given the existing elite a bit of a reprieve, but I'm hoping that when people read the book, they'll understand that we need a somewhat more fundamental change than that, and that Donald Trump is not the answer.
So in terms of what's happening now, it would seem to me, first of all, it's pretty shameful that the three world leaders that Trump most admires and is trying to do as much business with him as he possibly can, Kim Jong-un, Vladimir Putin, and MBS, have all conducted the most hideous and grisly and ruthless murders of dissidents on foreign soil. In Kim Jong-un's case, it was his own half-brother killed with a binary form of nerve gas. Putin's case, use of polonium against Litvinenko, and more recently, Novichok against Skripal in the UK, and then, of course, now MBS butchering, just like the Islamic State does. They butchered this dissident in the Saudi consulate in Istanbul. And my sense, Stephen, is that all of this effort on the part of Trump and Pompeo to give MBS cover is wasted. I don't think he wants cover. I think he wants the world to know, and more importantly, his own people to know that he has absolute impunity. And if you cross him, he'll kill you no matter where you are. So I have a feeling that all this waiting around for this Saudi statement of whatever excuse they're going to come up with, I don't think it's going to happen. I think MBS has such an arrogant attitude, and I'm sure their attitude is, if you take money from us, we own you. And in the case of Khashoggi, he was on the royal payroll until he crossed them. And I'm sure Trump and Jared Kushner have also been on their payroll, and I'm sure MBS feels that he owns both Jared and Trump.
Yeah, I'm not sure I would go so far as that, but I think there's a couple of important points to make about this pattern of behavior with Trump. The first point I would make is that there's simply a difference between caring about certain aspects of decent behavior, a certain set of ideals, certainly human rights and all of that, and recognizing that sometimes there are trade-offs between those ideals and other interests. I think that's been part of foreign policy, forever, including American foreign policy. That there's a difference between that, the recognition of trade-offs, and being utterly indifferent to the moral conduct of other governments. And I think that's been the case with his handling of North Korea and Russia and now Saudi Arabia. But the more important point is he hasn't gotten anything for this, right? He's bent over backwards to coddle these various regimes, but we don't have any progress towards disarmament with North Korea, and we're not likely to get it. We aren't getting anything from the unconditional support for Saudi Arabia. The behavior of Saudi Arabia over the last couple of years has not, in fact, been constructive in the region, whether it's their feud with Qatar, their behavior in Yemen, their attempts to manipulate Lebanese politics, and I think an effort to try and drag the United States into a pointless confrontation with Iran. And then finally, he seems to like Vladimir Putin, but his relationship with Putin is so tangled that he's, in fact, unable to make any real progress to trying to resolve the genuine differences we have with Russia now. By the way, a resolution which would be in our interest, I think in Russia's interest, and also in the interests of our European allies. It would be much better to have that relationship improve for all three countries, and Trump can't do anything about it because his relationship with Putin is so tangled.
And again, I'm speaking with Stephen Walter, who's the Robert and Renee Belfer Professor of International Affairs at Harvard University. And his latest book just out is The Hell of Good Intentions, America's Foreign Policy Elite and the Decline of U.S. Primacy. But at the moment, it would seem that things just as bad as they are, I think they're about to get incredibly much worse. I mean, we just had the almost killing of a top American general in Afghanistan, but for his body armor, he would have been killed along with the head of Afghan intelligence and a governor of an Afghan province by a Taliban, one of those, what's it called, blue on green or green on blue killings, which are all too frequent. That situation is going nowhere. I can't see anything else but eventually the U.S. having to pull out of that catastrophe. Longest war in its history, and it just gets worse by the day. But I think things are about to get so much worse with Iran, and I don't know whether this situation with MBS is going to change that trajectory or at least stall what seems to be a real, march towards war or march of folly, as Barbara Tuchman would say.
Right.
You've got the sanctions against Iran coming in on November the 5th. Isn't that similar to what happened with FDR sanctioning Japan prior to their entry into World War II at Pearl Harbor? In other words, if you cut off the Iranian oil and you need the Saudis to make up the difference, so that's why Trump is being so deferential, I'm sure, at the moment. But still, if they go ahead with their plan on November the 5th, isn't that going to be a complete catastrophe and could well lead to a war where the Iranians, just like the Japanese were in 1941, feel they have no choice but to go to war?
I actually think that's not going to happen, and that's the good news. I think there are worrisome scenarios here, but I think the analogy with Japan doesn't quite hold up. I don't think Iran is going to start anything if the United States imposes sanctions on it. We've sanctioned Iran in the past quite strictly. The difference is that prior to the Trump administration, we actually had effective multilateral sanctions. We had cooperation from the European Union. We had cooperation from Russia and China and Japan as well, all placing sanctions on Iran, and that's not going to be the case this time around. Russia is not going to sanction them. China is not going to sanction them. The Europeans would like to find a way to continue to deal with Europe without facing penalties from the United States. I think that's also likely to be true for Japan, and I think the Iranians will understand that the last thing they want to do is provoke the United States at this point, so they're going to ride this one out for the near term. What's interesting is that so far, I think Trump has been rather careful. He, I think, understood what happened to George Bush when he went into Iraq. I think he understood that the American people do not have a big appetite for another major conflict anywhere right now. And so he has, I think, resisted the idea of doing something militarily vis-a-vis Iran. What worries me, of course, is that he has advisors now, most notably John Bolton, who have openly advocated a forceful response to Iran in the past, have openly advocated for regime change. And the question is, will Trump, be swayed by them, or will they manipulate him into taking a decision that I don't really think he has the interest in? I think he understands that that's a loser in domestic politics, and all he really cares about is his own popularity and trying to get reelected. And I think a war with Iran does not help him there.
Well, short of a war with Iran, what's happening now is because the U.S. pulling out of the JCPOA, the G5 plus one, hasn't that forced the rest of the G5 to basically find a way around sanctions, and particularly the U.S.'s imposition of secondary sanctions? And you've written about it in your article at Foreign Policy, Stephen Wald, is that this may have the effect of the Russians, the Chinese, and the Europeans trying to find a way to get out of from under the dollar. And if Trump puts that at risk, the idea that the U.S. dollar is the global reserve currency, the advantages to the U.S. are enormous in that regard. And if Trump shoots America in the foot over this Iranian situation, won't that be one of the greatest self-inflicted wounds in American history?
I think there's no question that that's the case. Right now, again, other countries are resentful of the pressure they're getting from the United States. They would like to find some alternatives to this. That actually turns out to be hard to do. The American economy is still the linchpin of the world economy, and the dollar is the world's reserve currency. So constructing alternative arrangements is not something you can do in an afternoon, and it has significant economic consequences for these countries. So I think they'd rather not do it. But on the other hand, if you think you're dealing with essentially an unpredictable, capricious, rogue United States, you may have no choice. And other countries, even countries that are not fundamentally anti-American, like our European allies, resent being pushed around, especially when they think they're being pushed around in the service of the wrong cause. Right? These were countries who understood that the Iran nuclear deal was actually a good deal for us, a good deal for them, and a reasonable deal for Iran as well. So they think the Trump administration is being both foolish and a bit of a bully. I don't think it will come to the breakdown of a dollar-based international financial system, but it could, and it's certainly a step in that direction. Again, it's just another sign that the Trump administration does not really understand what America's long-term interests are.
Well, we've never had a situation where the head of state, the president of the United States, is doing business at the same time representing the United States. We don't know the extent to which he's representing himself as opposed to the United States. I mean, for example, the Saudis, of course, I'm sure they're very comfortable working with Trump and Kushner because that's how they do business, family to family. My sense of the real damage that Trump's doing is that he's emboldening these autocrats, and that the real challenge on the planet today is the survival of frail democracies against the encroachment of kleptocratic authoritarians. And this is what we seem to have a stark reminder of at the moment. You've got a kleptocrat and authoritarian in Turkey, and one in the White House, and one in Riyadh, Saudi Arabia, and they're all sort of negotiating their way out of this outrageous, horrendous act, which is, if we as a democracy don't stand for the basic human rights that are being violated in this case, then I think we've lost an enormous amount of ground. And as I say, I think we are losing ground in general. Democracies are losing ground to authoritarian regimes and kleptocracy. And the rule of law, in a global sense, is under threat.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, what has worried me most about the Trump administration, in fact, has not been what they were going to do in foreign policy, although that has been a concern of mine, but rather the effect they were having on the nature of American democracy, the degree to which it was responsible, the degree to which it was subject to the rule of law, and the damage they were doing to a lot of the informal norms that have held the country together in a variety of ways. This is why I think the elections coming up in November are so important. Part of what has allowed Trump to violate all of the previous traditions of, not entangling personal finances with foreign policy and all of the other ways in which the administration is clearly deeply corrupt, is that they've controlled both wings of Congress, and therefore there hasn't been any congressional oversight. The Republican Party has basically rolled over and played dead on this one. And it's possible that if Democrats gain control of the House, then at least part of Congress will start shining a spotlight on some of the things that are clearly deeply worrisome that we just don't know enough about right now.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Stephen Walt.
Great talking with you, Ian. Thanks again.
Thank you. And again, I'm speaking with Stephen Walt, who is the Robert and Renee Belfer Professor of International Affairs at Harvard University. He's the author of The Origins of Alliances, Revolution and War, Taming American Power, The Global Response to U.S. Primacy. And he's a co-author with John Mearsheimer of The Israel Lobby and U.S. Foreign Policy, a frequent writer for Foreign Policy, where his latest article is This is America's Middle East Strategy on Steroids. His latest book just out is The Hell of Good Intentions, America's Foreign Policy Elite and the Decline of U.S. Primacy. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into how the two biggest monopolies in the dialysis clinic business behind trying to defeat Proposition 8 almost destroyed Obamacare.
If we walk away, they'll walk away. But greed is a bottomless pit. And our freedom's a joke, we're just taking. And the whole world must watch the sad comic display. If you're still free, start running away. 'Cause we're coming for you.
Doctor, my eyes have seen the years and the slow parade of years without crying. Now I want to understand. I have done all that I could to see the evil and the good without hiding. You must help me if you can.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Michael Hiltzik, who's the Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter and columnist at the Los Angeles Times. He received the 1999 Pulitzer Prize for articles exposing corruption in the entertainment industry and currently writes a twice-weekly column, Golden State, covering business and economic issues relevant to life in California. His books include Colossus, Hoover Dam, and the Making of the American Century, and The New Deal in Modern History. And his latest article at the Los Angeles Times is How Profiteering by the Same Dialysis Firms Trying to Kill Proposition 8 Almost Destroyed Obamacare. Welcome to Background Briefing, Michael Hiltzik.
It's good to be back with you.
Well, thanks, Michael. It does seem that there's two propositions on the California ballot in November that seem to be entirely put together by powerful monopolies. In the case of the dialysis industry, there's these two big players who are behind Proposition 8, the Denver-based DeVito and the German-owned Fresenius. And then Proposition 11 is entirely being funded by AMR, which is a private EMS ambulance company, and they're pushing their interests. So it's probably happened before, but it just this seems, in both of these cases, pretty flagrant.
Well, I think this is one of the enduring drawbacks of California's initiative system. It's very vulnerable to being manipulated or taken over by private interests, and we've seen this, in fact, over and over again. We've seen companies from Pacific Gas and Electric to many others who have tried to put over initiatives that really are designed to line their own pockets. We came close to having yet another initiative on the ballot that would have been put up by three former manufacturers of lead paint. Sherwin-Williams was one of them, ConAgra. These are mega companies that were trying to get out of a court judgment requiring them to pay hundreds of millions of dollars to clean up lead paint and old housing. And eventually they withdrew that because I think, we did. In fact, I did quite a bit to expose their role in it. But it was only withdrawn in June. It got approved for the ballot before that.
And I think the Supreme Court just ruled on that, didn't they?
Yes. Well, the Supreme Court basically rebuffed an effort by the paint companies to have the court review California rulings. Mm-hmm. So basically, the California rulings stand, and they're going to have to fund a $409 million fund to abate old lead paint.
So let's turn to what you've revealed in your article in the Los Angeles Times, Michael Hiltzik, the extent to which the people behind Proposition 8, these two monopoly companies that operate most of the dialysis clinics in this country, DaVita and Fresenius. DaVita earned a pre-tax profit of $1.8 billion on $10.1 billion in dialysis revenues last year, and Fresenius reported pre-tax operating profits of $2.3 billion on dialysis revenue on $11.7 billion earned in North America. So what was their connection to the attacks on the Affordable Care Act, or Obamacare as it's known?
Right. Well, I should say at the outset that, just to be clear, those two firms, and it's DaVita and Fresenius, are trying to kill Proposition 8. Proposition 8 was put up by the Service Employees Union, which is trying to unionize those two companies. And Proposition 8 would basically set standards for staffing at these companies, hundreds of clinics in California, and would also put a cap on their profits based on how much they spend on staffing. In other words, if they spend more on rank-and-file staffing at these clinics, they'll be able to book a higher profit. So these two companies are trying to kill it. Their contributions to the No on 8 campaign, I believe, have just exceeded $100 million. They were 99 and a half when I counted them last week, and I think they put more in. So this is on its way to being the most costly initiative campaign, pro and con, that we've had in the history of California, which means the history of the United States. Now, turning to what they were up to and how their business model really undermined the Affordable Care Act, we need to go into the history of dialysis coverage a little bit, if your listeners will bear with me. Back in the 1970s, it became clear that dialysis was so expensive, and at that time, it cost about $90,000 a year to keep a kidney patient on dialysis. Generally, the patients have to go in to get dialyzed or basically to have their blood filtered three times a week because their kidneys are no longer working. It's a lengthy process. It's, as I said, very expensive. It requires a lot of medication, a lot of equipment. Dialysis patients tend to spend more time than the average in the hospitals. And as a result, in the 1970s, it became clear that these patients could not get health insurance. There wasn't an insurer in the country that would commit itself to covering a patient who was likely to be so expensive. So Congress passed a law, and Richard Nixon signed it, that basically created a single-payer system for dialysis sufferers, and that was by making them eligible for Medicare, no matter whether they were 65, the standard eligibility age, or 35. So you now had this system where if you needed dialysis, Medicare would pay for it. And this was a boon. Basically, it meant that dialysis patients could get care. Now, fast forward to the Affordable Care Act, and starting on January 1st, 2015, it was no longer legal for a private insurance company to reject an applicant because of a pre-existing medical condition. And that meant that if a dialysis patient applied for coverage, they had to get that coverage from the insurance company at the standard rate. They couldn't be charged more for their insurance. They couldn't be rejected. And the final factor in this is that Medicare was paying these dialysis firms about $250, maybe $300 per session. The private insurers could be billed because dialysis was always an out-of-network procedure. The dialysis firms could bill private insurers $2,500, $4,000, in some cases even $10,000 per session. So it was enormously more profitable for the dialysis to have patients who were covered by Obamacare or by other private insurance than to have them on Medicare. And the result was that you had, the allegations are, that the dialysis firms, once again DaVita and Fresenius, were trying to steer their patients. If a patient came in with Medicare coverage, the social worker at the clinic would be incentivized to say to the patient, you know, you would do better if you dropped your Medicare and signed up with private insurance. And that happened. They didn't need a huge number of patients to make that switch in order to suddenly have much bigger profits. So what happened? You know, in 2015, 2016, early 2017, we started to hear from private insurance companies that they wanted to bail out of Obamacare. We had United Health, which said, you know, which spent a year covering Obamacare patients and then said, we are pulling out of the program entirely. You had Aetna, which went 1 week from saying, we see Obamacare as sort of an investment in the future. 2 weeks later, they turned around and said, we're bailing out in half the states. Anthem, a Blue Cross co-op of insurance companies, said, we're seeing a huge amount of very expensive patients we did not expect, so we are going to reconsider whether we're going to participate in these exchanges. Now, when you drill down to what was going on, it turns out that the most expensive patients that the insurers were beginning to see were dialysis patients, and that was because they were being encouraged to drop Medicare and move to this private coverage through Obamacare because they could no longer be rejected, and that was really a phenomenon that the insurance companies say was being driven by DaVita and Fresenius for it to line their own pockets. And it almost destroyed Obamacare. If you think back to that period, we had Republicans saying, look, the big insurance companies, they're all trying to bail out of Obamacare because the system doesn't work. What was really going on was that there was profiteering by these dialysis firms.
And, of course, because Obamacare covered pre-existing conditions, these two dialysis monopolies, DaVita and Fresenius, were exploiting that, were they not?
That's exactly what they were doing. They knew that if they could get patients, or if patients at their clinics would apply for insurance from commercial firms, they could not be denied it, as they had been getting denied in the 70s and right up to 2014. They could no longer be denied, and as a result, the billings at Fresenius and DaVita were going to be much, much greater. And, of course, by the same token, the costs to the private insurance companies also were going to be much, much greater.
So, as we started out, there are two, and maybe more, I haven't really followed the ballots that closely in terms of the propositions on the California ballot. They're always deceptive, and you always have to be very careful and very studious in trying to figure them out. They really are quite often quite mendacious. But Prop 11 is a for-profit ambulance company. They are behind Prop 11. So, if you don't like the idea of a monopoly trying to shield itself from liability, then you would vote no on Prop 11. But on Prop 8, that's put forth by the union, SEIU, and the big monopolies in the dialysis business, DaVita and Fresenius, are behind the no on Prop 8 campaign, and they are spending a record amount of money, which is not just a record in terms of money spent on a proposition in California, or in this case against a proposition in California, but this would be an American record in terms of spending. So, Michael, obviously propaganda works. We know that money talks. So do you think they're going to pull this off? I mean, I heard a proponent for Prop 8 against the monopolies, against these two, and he had worked with them. He was on Larry Mantle's program the other day, and he was just terrible. So I don't know that they're running the best campaign, whereas the other side is spending $100 million. So what's your reading on the pulse of the gullibility, or conversely, the intelligence of the voters in California? Are they going to get suckered by this multi-billion-dollar monopolies who are spending $100 million simply to maintain their outrageous profits?
Well, I don't really know how it's going to work, and I haven't seen, to be more accurate, I haven't looked at the polling. I can tell you that I've written about Proposition 8. I've written about the dialysis firms twice, the first time back in July when I laid out, you know, their business model, and then again last week, or really earlier this week when I, you know, made the connection to Obamacare. And the response that I've gotten from my readers when I've done these pieces is that they are very confused by what Proposition 8 will or won't do, or whether it will help or hurt. And of course, I think the confusion works in favor of the dialysis firms, because when people are uncertain, I think they'll tend to vote no. Certainly, it's true that the yes on 8 camp is seriously outgunned in spending. You know, you see a lot of no on 8 ads. You don't see very many yes on 8 ads. The dialysis firms, as I pointed out in July, you know, they went out and they paid for a study, you know, one of these supposedly objective studies that actually is commissioned by one side or another. And the study purported to say that if Proposition 8 passed, hundreds of these clinics in the state of California would have to close because they would no longer be profitable. I think you have to take that with a grain of salt, given that it was funded by the dialysis firms themselves. And when I analyzed it, I showed that a lot of its assumptions were faulty. These dialysis firms make an enormous amount of money. Dialysis is really profitable for them, and I think they would probably have a lot less trouble than they claim finding ways to keep these clinics profitable, even under the regulations that would come in under Proposition 8. And as I've also pointed out, if Proposition 8 passes, it would still be up to state agencies to make determinations about how to implement it, and that could go against the dialysis firms. It could be neutral to them. It could be stringent. There's a whole range of possibilities, but they've got a lot of money, and I'm sure they'd be able to get a lot of what they want out of the State Department of Health and Human Services, which would, or the State Department of Public Health, which would have jurisdiction. So the point that I tried to make is that if you are deciding who to trust in this particular campaign, this is what you should know about the firms that are trying to kill this initiative, because it's going to eat into their bottom line. They have not shown themselves. You know, I get a lot of comments from readers saying, you know, my relative goes to dialysis. He or she goes to DaVita. They're really nice to him there. They do a great job. You know, how can you call for a measure that's going to force this clinic to close? Where would my mother go? Where would my sister go? What have you? All I can say is, you know, I don't think you can take it as read by any means that these clinics are going to close. I think DaVita and Fresenius will very much stay in business, though, you know, they may not make quite as much money as they made in the past. And the idea that they're only out looking out for their patients, I think, is basically a claim that really needs to be examined pretty carefully.
Well, on top of that, I think if the average voter in California recognized what you brought to the table, Michael Hilsig, that these companies have almost tried to destroy, or they were responsible for undermining Obamacare in a very drastic way, which, of course, is very popular in this state. And this is the state where Obamacare has been most successful. So on top of the...
Well, that's true. It's not only popular in this state. It's popular in many other states. Right. And one other thing I would point out is that back in 2016, the Obama administration, you know, its Medicare and Medicaid authorities actually tried to put through a rule that would limit the ability of these dialysis firms to exploit and game the system. They promulgated the rule in December of 2016. It was suspended by a conservative federal judge in Texas. And then what happened, of course, is that the Trump administration came into power, and it's stopped the development of that rule. So, you know, that's what we're seeing, is that, you know, we could have had a federal regulations that put limitations on these firms' ability to game the system, and those are no longer on the board.
Well, Michael Hilsig, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
My pleasure.
And I've been speaking with Michael Hilsig, who's a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter and columnist at the Los Angeles Times. He received the 1999 Pulitzer Prize for his articles exposing corruption in the entertainment business, and currently he writes the twice-weekly column Golden State, and he's the author of Colossus, Hoover Dam, and the Making of the American Century, and The New Deal, A Modern History, and his latest article at the Los Angeles Times is How Profiteering by the Same Dialysis Firms Trying to Kill Proposition 8 Almost Destroyed Obamacare. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. We can contact me and scroll down the right-hand side and sign up for iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.